Hello and welcome to the latest edition of Cooper Talks. On a bit of a roll here, and throwing out another history one, this time focused on the outbreak of World War II. So this is kind of, if you're doing it, IGCSE, GCSE revision of the build-up to World War II. But hey, people might find this fun and groovy for any number of reasons. So the outbreak of World War II could sometimes be described as maybe, or certainly when I was doing it many, many moons ago for my GCSE, was described as Hitler's five steps to war, which is probably the wrong way to think about it, because it suggests that Hitler wanted World War II, and it's important to understand that he didn't. Hitler certainly wanted military conquest, and he had his key aims, which I'll come to, but he never, ever wanted a major long-term European war. The reason for that being that that's what Germany had lost, why Germany had lost World War I. They couldn't sustain it. Equally, the German people didn't want that. So that's one of the key things to remember, that Hitler, for all his dictatorial powers and so on, certainly couldn't risk antagonising or going against the mass will of the German people, who had no appetite for a long-term war. And that's one of the reasons why he developed the Blitzkrieg, the lightning war, fast strikes, and it was all about pushing boundaries, seeing what he could get away with, but whilst avoiding a major conflict. And that is, of course, until the invasion of Poland. But it was always with that in mind. So important things to remember. Now, what about Hitler's aims? I think if you're going to look at this, you need to think of all the actions, everything that happened in the context of Hitler's aims. Now, these have been pretty consistent since he wrote Mein Kampf back in 1923-24, following his failed Munich putsch. But in this, the key aims were to abolish the Treaty of Versailles, to destroy this humiliation on Germany. He wanted to expand German territory, particularly to Eastern Europe, to gain Lebensraum, living space, and to stand up and defy communism. Those were his big foreign policy aims. Within that, it would be to restore German pride and national identity, and of course, sight view to capturing treasure and so on. But that was the aim of the conquests. So you can see each step or each action or event in that context. So, again, to explain kind of the Nazis, and this goes back to the Great Depression, the Treaty of Versailles had, of course, always been hated. But it had been reformed, thanks to things like the Dawes Plan and the Locarno Treaties and so on. But it wasn't that big an issue in 1928. In 1928, the Nazis won less than 1% of the vote in Germany. So what changed to lead to them getting into power in January 1933? The Great Depression. And the Great Depression caused chaos and misery in Germany, and the hatred towards the Treaty of Versailles was a useful tool to whip up German nationalism and German anger and hatred, which would help get Hitler into power. And so that's why, or the main reason why Hitler exploited the Treaty of Versailles. He also himself personally hated it and saw it as a humiliation. Now, in terms of the key events going to the war, we're going to look at these events. Starting with rearmament, then we'll look at the initial attempt at Anschluss with Austria that failed, the Saar plebiscite, remilitarization of the Rhineland, the Spanish Civil War, the success of Anschluss with Austria, Sudetenland and Poland. We might not do this all in one episode. Probably get to Anschluss, I think. Let's see how it goes. I don't want to go over half an hour. Anyway, so that's the key areas. Now, what are the things that we need to know about with rearmament? So Hitler comes to power in 1933, and once he's secure in his position, he starts attempting to rearm Germany, to increase the production of forces, to bring people into the army. Now, this actually financially made a lot of sense. It was done on borrowing, but it certainly helped him to reduce unemployment by getting people into the military. And by putting in big weapons orders, manufacturing orders, he was able to stimulate the economy and get it going again. Of course, there is a long-term problem with this, because the military spending doesn't bring its own economic benefits. You know, you can build as many tanks as you like, but tanks don't then generate money unless you use them for conquest. You know, same problem in the Cold War era that people have with nuclear bombs. They cost a lot of money to make and maintain, but they don't generate money on their own. And that's one of the reasons why Germany, although it looked good in the initial stages under Hitler economically, in the long term, it couldn't succeed because it was all built on the assumption that Germany would conquer and acquire new territories. So in the short term, rearmament made financial sense. But more than anything, it was a means of defying the Treaty of Versailles. And of course, this plays into the failure of the disarmament conference that was being held in 1933-34. Other countries are refusing to disarm. And Hitler says, well, hang on, if you're refusing to disarm, why should Germany remain the only country at risk? Not only that, obviously played into his key promise of breaking the Treaty of Versailles by saying, we're going to have conscription, we're going to increase the number of forces in the army, we're going to build aeroplanes and tanks and so on. But it also chimed with a rising fear, particularly in Britain, but also in America, of the communist threat. And it's worth bearing in mind that throughout the 1930s, the bigger threat, certainly to Britain, in Britain's mind, and to a degree in France, was communist USSR. Now, because it was a communist socialist state, it was less impacted, certainly appeared less impacted by the Great Depression than other countries, because it wasn't part of the global trading market, not clearly anyway. And so because that was surviving and doing quite well, they seemed to pose the bigger threat to European democracy. And they were, in this sense, from a British point of view, the Nazis were bad, but they weren't as bad as the communists. And that's certainly how it appeared in the 1930s. So when Hitler starts rearming and remilitarizing, increasing the number of warships between 1932 and 39 from 30 to 95, the number of aircraft from 36 in 1932 to 8,250 by 1939, and 100,000 soldiers in 1932 all the way up to 950,000 in the regular army by 1939. He was basically creating a stronger threat or a stronger challenge to communist Russia. And although it was breaking the Treaty of Versailles, in the 1930s, this was seen as useful from an allies, well, from a British and to a degree the French point of view. And of course, from a German point of view, the ordinary German people, it was about unemployment, breaking the Treaty of Versailles, but in itself didn't guarantee war. It was just bringing them back level with the other countries that had failed to disarm. And he'd started off in secret, and by the time it got publicly displayed, he already had quite a lot of weapons. And he used the disarmament conference to justify what he'd already done and to withdraw from the League of Nations. So Hitler, by 1935, starts parading them around, having the big rallies and sort of getting the troops marching through Germany, all as a way of whipping up nationalistic pride, but also showing the potential threat of them and basically sending a message that he was breaking the terms of the Treaty of Versailles. And it gained him a lot of support, really popular in Germany. And actually, Britain in the end basically said, yeah, this is better than nothing. And so signed the Anglo-German Naval Agreement, basically said Hitler could have a bigger army. The French wanted to oppose this because they saw a rearmed Germany as a greater threat. But without British support, there wasn't a lot they could do about it. So although rearmament started fairly soon, it doesn't become a big thing, really, a public thing until 1935, by which time it's already a bit late. And so on that note, I'm just going to suggest now that in 1934, so only in power for a year, Hitler did attempt to try and persuade the Austrians or try and have Anschluss with Austria, try and get a union of Greater Germany. I should say one of his other aims, I didn't mention earlier, was to unite all German speakers. And he felt that extending Austria or making Austria part of Greater Germany would be a part of that. And also just as a link back, sorry, I'm a bit off track here, but also as a link back, the unite all German speakers kind of played into the Wilsonian point of national self-determination. It gave Hitler a means of justifying conquering territories in order to have national self-determination, to make sure all Germans were governed by one German government. That's going to be quite important later on. So anyway, he tried in 1934, and it was Mussolini who basically said no. And in 1934, the Italians were in a far, far stronger position militarily than Germany. And they certainly saw southern Austria as kind of their territory. They had an eye on it themselves for influence, the sort of Lombard region that borders Austria, traditional disputed territory. So they had their eye on it. And Mussolini didn't want Hitler taking over Austria and getting a border with him in 1934. So Mussolini basically said no, and Hitler backed down and didn't pursue Anschluss at that point. So it's worth bearing in mind the power dynamics here, and that Italy did have form in 1934 of standing up to Hitler and saying no, which again will be quite important later on. So what was the next moment? Well, the next big moment was the Saar plebiscite. Now, if you remember, the Treaty of Versailles had made the Saar region, big industrial region with lots of coal deposits, had made it a mandate of the League of Nations. It was run directly by the League. But they said after 15 years, they could have a plebiscite, a vote, a type of referendum, to determine whether they would remain part of the League or join with France or possibly return to Germany. Now that came up in 1934. So Hitler's in power, 1935, because it was 1920 when it initially happened. It wasn't clear how the Saar region would go. The Saar region is in the west of Germany, generally not quite as nationalistic as, say, the Prussian parts, the eastern parts of Germany. And it done quite well out of the League and actually been more successful than being part of Germany. So it wasn't clear what they would do. In order to try and justify things, Hitler used Joseph Goebbels to come up with a load of propaganda and really push for the Nazis, using all the sort of swastikas up, the flags, and the focus on German nationalism and German pride. And actually managed to get about 90% of the people who vote persuaded to return to Greater Germany, this idea of Germany becoming great again, rebuilding and expanding that. So the propaganda really paid off. And basically the Saar returned, and Hitler went, that's it, I'm fine now, we've got the Saar back, I'm a happy bunny, don't worry France, I've got no more claims to French territory, I just wanted the Saar coal fields back, and now they're back, Germany is whole. So it was perfectly legal, and it happened in the rules of them, but of course Hitler's using his propaganda to manipulate things, but it did, he was able to parade it as kind of a defiance of the Treaty of Versailles, although it was all done legally. His sort of nationalistic pride, his vision of restoring Germany to its former whole. So not only did he use propaganda to get the result, but he used the event itself as propaganda to boost his credentials. Again, France wasn't happy about this, but it was all done legally, so what could they do about it? Now, the next thing that happened was the remilitarization of the Rhineland. Now, this happens in March 1936. So it's worth bearing in mind that in the background to all of this, although it's a bit early, in the background to all of this is the Abyssinian crisis, okay? That's the big thing that's distracting Britain and France. So again, it wasn't that Hitler just went, hey, I fancy remilitarizing the Rhineland. He chose the time very deliberately. While Britain and France were distracted by Italy, Hitler chose this moment to send troops into the Rhineland area in direct defiance of the League of Nations. The Treaty of Versailles. So he's sending the troops over the bridges, crossing into the Rhineland. Now, it's worth bearing in mind, something we've learned since is that Hitler did give direct orders that if there was any sign of opposition by France or Britain, the troops should turn around and come straight back into, leave the Rhineland straight away. So Hitler clearly wasn't confident. He didn't want to go to war here. He didn't want to fight to remilitarize the Rhineland. And in terms of strategic gain, it didn't mean anything. The Rhineland was German territory. There was nothing new to be gained here. It would just be a question of locating German troops in the area. But it was a statement of principle. Now, from the French point of view, they were kind of hampered by the fact the Locarno treaties had been signed earlier, which had allowed, in 1926, had allowed Germany to join the League of Nations by promising to respect its western boundaries. So with that treaty in mind, Hitler and Britain could justify Hitler having the troops stationed in the Rhineland because he'd promised, well, Germany had promised to respect the Western boundary. So Belgium, Luxembourg and France had nothing to fear as long as Hitler and Germany stuck to the treaties. But also, France had signed a treaty of mutual protection with the Soviet Union. And again, Hitler was able to turn this into a defence mechanism and say, hang on, we're surrounded here by the Soviet Union and France. We need to be able to defend ourselves from a potential French attack. Therefore, we should be allowed to have our troops in. So rather than playing it as German militarism, as in we want to go and attack the French, he made it about German defensism. So we want to defend ourselves from a potential French attack, otherwise the French might go storming through the Rhineland and we lose a big chunk of our territory. At the same time, Britain's attitudes towards the Treaty of Versailles were changing. A lot of British people felt the Treaty of Versailles had been too harsh. They certainly didn't want to get involved in a war defending French territory or German territory again. And remilitarization of the Rhineland, well, the Rhineland was German anyway. It wasn't like they were conquering anything new. So they were okay about it. And at the same time, the British government is distracted by the whole Abyssinian crisis and is dealing with Italy. So Hitler gets away with it. And once he got away with it, without Britain standing up to it and without France standing up on its own, Hitler basically got away with it. And having got away with it, you couldn't really then put the genie back in the bottle. You couldn't turn around and say, oh, you've had your troops in here for several months now, please could you remove them. Once they were there, they were there, and it just became accepted. So the remilitarization of the Rhineland, which was the second big step, the Saar plebiscite was the smaller one, but the second big step on the road to war, was a gamble by Hitler. He knew there was a risk and he didn't want to lose it, but he took his chance. And British and French attitudes allowed him to get away with it. And that meant he'd defied the Treaty of Versailles. His rearmament had become an accepted thing as well. And it showed that the British and French and the League of Nations were kind of weak and unwilling to stand up to him. So it also sends a message that, you know, people aren't willing to go to war. That he can push things a bit more. And they'll give in to his demands. So it's a dangerous precedent that's set. Now, of course, 1936 is dominated by two other major things, one of which is the Abyssinian crisis, which I talked about in the League of Nations podcast from the 1930s. The other one is the Spanish Civil War. And the Spanish Civil War is an important thing from the point of view of the build-up to World War II, because it was here that Hitler and Germany and Mussolini as well were able to forge an alliance and work together in an anti-communist league, supporting the nationalist General Franco, because he seemed to have a similar worldview. And he will become aligned with fascist views, but he'd started off as a nationalist and a monarchist against the Republicans and against the communist forces in Spain. So although publicly Mussolini and Hitler promised not to interfere and not to get involved, although they supported Franco, they did send over a lot of equipment and troops. And Germany in particular used it as a means of experimenting with tactics that they could then utilise in the war. The most obvious of this was the bombing of cities like Guernica and attacking civilian populations. Again, it's this idea of blitz, of bombing the civilian population into submission, that was experimented with in the Spanish Civil War and will then come to play a major part in World War II itself. The other point was it allowed them to develop the tactics of blitzkrieg and of using the air support in conjunction with the ground support. And these are tactics that they will be able to utilize sufficiently when it comes to later invasions. The other major consequence or consequences of the Spanish Civil War was that Britain and France's failure to adequately support the anti-fascist forces, either the Republican government or the communist government in Spain, raises suspicions in Stalin's mind over in the USSR. So remember, a year earlier, he'd signed a treaty with France of mutual protection against Germany. But then he sees that in Spain, Britain and France kind of leave Spain to its own devices, that they're kind of hoping unofficially that the communists will supply weapons and troops to defy the fascists. But Britain and France aren't willing to get involved themselves. And this sends a warning message to Stalin that actually Britain and France will allow communist USSR to deal with Hitler and Mussolini so that they don't have to muddy their boots. They don't have to get involved themselves. So the Spanish Civil War makes Stalin suspicious of the motives of Britain and France. The other consequence from a British point of view was that the nature of the warfare and the escalation just highlighted, actually, in terms of aerial warfare, how far behind Britain was. And so this is the point at which the British government will start to massively increase its spending on weapons. But by this stage, it's actually fallen, in terms of equipment, quite a long way behind Germany and Italy, certainly in aircraft and tanks. At the same time, coming out of this alliance between Italy and Germany, we get the Axis agreement between Germany and Italy being formed, which Japan will also agree to in their sort of militaristic aggression, military force for a very right-wing nationalistic cause. So this mutual protection, and of course Japan and Italy are main members of the League of Nations, and in this pact that they make, they will basically stand up and protect Hitler. And of course, the whole thing going on with Abyssinia and sort of the focus of Britain and France on the Abyssinian crisis allows Hitler to then strike with his third major step, which is Anschluss with Austria. So, as we said, in 1934, Hitler had tried to unify Austria with Greater Germany and had failed because of Mussolini. But by 1938, Mussolini is now his ally. And with the Abyssinian crisis dealt with, it's quite clear where Mussolini is going to stand. So now the idea of a union between Austria and Germany is less likely to be opposed by Italy. And that creates a problem for Britain and France, because they're the ones that are going to have to deal with it. Okay, so that's a big change from 1934, the Axis deal between Italy and Germany. The other thing was, by 1938, Germany had made, certainly in public, and thanks to all the propaganda, huge it had made a lot of progress economically and militarily. A lot of nationalistic pride had gone forward, and Germany looked like a great country to be a part of. At the same time, Austria was doing okay, but not doing as well. So there was a bit more of an attraction there. Austria, like Germany, had developed its own Nazi party, which would use similar tactics to that of Hitler. It would have its own version of the brown shirts that would basically cause problems, cause crime, disrupt communications and so on, cause chaos on the streets, which they would then blame on the communists and say, look, we need a strong Nazi presence in order to put this down. As well as regular democratic demonstrations for union with Germany. Basically, the Austrian Chancellor Schuschnigg, I'm not sure if that's how you say it, but I reckon it is, but Schuschnigg doesn't really want Anschluss, and he kind of appeals to Britain and France, says, look, the Nazis in Austria are causing this, they're putting huge disruption on, we can't run things, I need help, I need to stand up to Hitler, I don't want Anschluss, I don't want to join with him, but I need your help to resist him. But again, Britain in particular doesn't want to get involved. Again, what's the harm? It's national self-determination, uniting German speakers. If that's what the Austrian people want, who are we to stand in their way? You know, if you have a plebiscite or a referendum, you have to stick to it no matter what. Britain kind of just doesn't want to get involved. So Britain and France propose or suggest that there's a plebiscite held, you know, say, have a referendum, have a vote, see what the Austrian people actually want. Now, again, that sounds nice in theory, but democracy can be abused. Hitler basically sends in his troops, so he marches in order to assure a free and fair referendum result, under the guise that there was lots of civil unrest and disobedience going on in Austria, so you couldn't be sure that it would be a free and fair vote. Of course, it was the Nazi Party in Austria stirring up all the trouble. I mean, not all of it, but most of it. So it was obviously all fake. And then once he was there, the troops could threaten and keep a watchful eye on who was voting and how people were voting, overseeing the counting. And of course, it made it easy to access with Goebbels' propaganda. So again, any politics students watching this should always know that a result that's 99.75% for one side is almost certainly fixed. You just don't get results that lopsided unless something's gone wrong. However, Britain and France said, hey, well, they clearly want it, accept the referendum result and move on. So they didn't stand up for it, even though it was a direct defiance of the Treaty of Versailles again. And this was the first time Hitler was actually expanding German territory. By bringing Austria into the Greater Germany, his territory, or German territory, is the boundaries are expanding. With the Rhineland, with the Saar plebiscite, Germany hadn't got any bigger as such. I mean, the Saar, that was always likely to go back to Germany in many ways. But this is an expansion, an aggressive military takeover. But Britain and France did nothing. The reason for that, Neville Chamberlain, the British Prime Minister at the time, felt they might work well together, might be good for the economy and certainly make them stronger standing up to a potential communist threat. What else are you going to do in this rise of dictators? So it was a gamble, but it's a gamble that paid off for Hitler. Now, it wasn't just because he got to unify German speakers, and it wasn't just for breaking the Treaty of Versailles, but Austria, being quite mountainous with the Alps and everything, has quite a lot of natural reserves, particularly iron ore, which Hitler was in desperate need of to keep developing his army and industry. And so he gains quite a lot. There's huge prestige. Germany now has a Reich, an empire with which is expanded. It's defied the Treaty of Versailles. It gains Hitler popularity, and he's managed to do all this without firing a single shot. You know, he hasn't had to declare war. So the German people think this is amazing. And the message goes out yet again that Hitler can gamble, he can push the boundaries, he can defy the Treaty of Versailles, and Britain and France will not take any military action. And with Mussolini and Japan as his allies, the League is not a threat to him at all. So by the end of by 1938, when he's acquired the whole of Austria, Hitler's in a really strong position. His military has grown in strength to one that is now competitive, though still smaller than Britain and France combined. He's got the backing of the German people for these short wars. He's expanded German territory. He's defied the Treaty of Versailles and the League of Nations quite openly. And he's gone from a relatively weak position to a relatively strong position. That will be much, much harder to deal with going forward. Plus, by this stage, the League of Nations has completely failed over Abyssinia, and the Soviet Union has started to distrust Britain and France as potential allies in an anti-fascist league. So for all those reasons, the Anschluss with Austria kind of marked a decisive moment, or a point of no return, we should say, in the progress to World War II. It was at this moment that Germany kind of becomes too strong and Britain and France appear too weak. And for that reason, Britain and France will start turning towards a policy of appeasement for dealing with Germany as it tries to make greater progress into new territory that had no claim to be German. But as we're nearly at half an hour now, I'm going to wrap it up here, and I will finish this off in a future podcast. So that's kind of the early part of the road to World War II. It's the pre-appeasement part, the sort of build-up and gathering of Hitler's powers. It's sometimes tied in with appeasement, but it's worth remembering appeasement really is the last stage, the last couple of years before World War II itself broke out. But I shall talk more about that next time. Please feel free to drop any comments or write a review of some sort. Feedback is always welcome. I hope this wasn't too dull or tedious for you. And if it was, I do apologise. But I think the history speaks for itself and should just inspire you with these stories. And if they don't, I'm just very sorry, but assume it's me that's boring rather than the history. Anyway, thank you very much for your time, and I will speak to you again soon. Bye.